Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, this is Robin Johnson, and welcome back to another edition of the Best of Heartland Politics, a radio show I began in 2014 that's now a regular show and podcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. My list of favorite interviews would not be complete without my show featuring Tom Brokaw from 2015. A good friend of mine who worked with Brokaw at NBC News arranged the interview. Brokaw and I talked about his latest book recounting his battle with cancer. The book is titled A Lucky Life Interrupted, A Memoir of Hope. Of course, I was a big fan of Tom Brokaw during his entire career at NBC and enjoyed reading his books as well, especially those accounts of him growing up in the Midwest region. He's become an elder statesman for the nation and brings some good old common sense perspective to issues and concerns. This was really a great honor, a treat for me to be able to talk with Tom Brokaw, and I hope you enjoy this episode of the Best of Heartland Politics. Good morning and welcome to Talking Politics with Robin Johnson. Today is a treat and an honor for me personally and for my listeners because today I'm interviewing Tom Brokaw, the former NBC News anchor, the winner of the 2014 Presidential Medal of Freedom, and the author of 7 books. Tom, welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing good. Doing good. I mentioned the books you've authored, and I've read about half of them, and most of them focus on, of course, most people are aware of The Greatest Generation, the book you wrote about the World War II veterans, and this latest book is a little bit different. Tell us about it, if you will.
Well, a year and a half ago, I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, which is a difficult cancer. It's a blood and bone cancer, and I began keeping a journal because it's an instinct. I've been a journalist for half a century, and then I realized I was learning so much every day about what families go through that I could probably turn it into a book. I was at the advantage of getting excellent care. My family includes my daughter, who's an emergency room physician of some renown. She came and helped me with the case. My wife was critical to the daily management of it, and there are so many things that we were all learning, even though we felt we were informed about what goes on with cancer, that I decided to turn it into a book, and then it became kind of a memoir as well, because I was reminded of all the adventures that I've had over the years. So A Lucky Life Interrupted.
Yes, you mentioned the role of your family and what you call, quote, Team Brokaw, which I thought was interesting. I went through this last year. My father had cancer, and I think it is clear that family is the best treatment for cancer patients.
Well, I think that there's kind of two groups. There are people who know folks who have cancer and they're sympathetic, but until you get cancer, you cannot be empathetic. And my mind now is that if one member of a family gets cancer, everybody in a way in that family gets cancer as well, because it becomes a simple theme of the family and their lives. And I wanted to try to help them through that.
So as part of the book, I thought there were some very timely observations on the U.S. healthcare system and with your experience going through it. Take us through some of those, the positive attributes, but areas that brought you concern as well.
Well, it's an uneven process. I mean, it's pure genius in so many ways, but it's getting to be more complicated for patients to sort out, A, where they should go for what kind of treatment, B, what the costs are. My line is, and I've come to be over a lot of years, I've been interested in healthcare as a journalist for a long time, and I think most patients walk into a doctor's office treated like a Mayan temple, which they don't speak the language. And what I do in the book is encourage them to ask tough questions, to get prepared before they get there, and then develop an ombudsman, somebody in the medical community or somebody who's a medical expert who can help you through the process. A friend of mine who's an editor of a major magazine said, you know, we would never print something without at least 2 sources or 3 sources. And a lot of physicians believe that they're the only source. Well, that just can't be the case. That's not a knock on the medical community. It's just that it's subjective profession in so many ways, and you have the right and the obligation in terms of dealing with your health, of making sure that you're paying as much attention to who's going to take care of you as you do to buying a flat screen television or a car. So I think that we need to be better informed consumers. A, B, there's a big consolidation going on now. The community hospitals are drying up in smaller towns in Iowa and across the country because, first of all, it's not affordable. Healthcare is becoming very expensive. And we have to think about how we can treat people who live in more remote areas. And then finally, what I think is that Medicare cannot be sustained at the level. So I think people who are in the upper income, and I'm one of them, need to be paying more for Medicare at a lower, you know, the cost of Medicare for them should check in at a lower income level. If they're making, as some are now, more than $1 million a year, they should start paying into Medicare right away on their taxes. So they're paying a greater share of their income than the poor and working class are.
One point I thought you made in the book that certainly was similar to the experience my family had was sometimes the lack of communication among doctors that are treating you, and you give the example of the Mayo Clinic and how they approach healthcare as a better way to go about it, and the fact that we still don't have that enough in this country. You might talk about that a little bit as well.
Yeah, well, the Mayo Clinic, and I'm a public trustee, so I have a biased view of it. I think it's the most brilliant healthcare system in the world because, in part, back in the 1920s when they realized the extraordinary volume of patients they were dealing with, they were going to have to develop really sophisticated systems. So if you have a reasonably complicated condition and say you're being treated by an internist and an oncologist and maybe even a spinal person because bones are wrong, they all are seeing the same thing at the same time and you're dealing with heat. In most healthcare systems in America, you deal with the oncologist, he or she leaves, and then you deal with the spinal person, he or she leaves, and they're not wearing the same team colors as I describe it. And I can't imagine why more healthcare systems just don't adopt the Mayo system.
Yeah, it's that's a great question, and I think Obamacare tried to move in that direction. You had some thoughts about Obamacare as well, where some of the good it's done, but maybe perhaps a different way they could have gone about it.
What happens, again, it's back to the business that it seems so mysterious to most people, and they're reluctant to shake the system up because they don't want to offend a doctor that they care about. A lot of people pick a doctor based on personality, and that's not what you should be doing. You should be really picking a physician based on record and medical expertise. And if they're cranky, that's okay because they know how to fix you. But I, time after time after time, as we all do, you'll ask somebody about the doctor and say, "Oh, he's the sweetest guy in the world," or "She is the nicest person. We talk about our family." That's what I, not what I need to know. I want to know what their record is and treating the condition that you go to them for.
Yeah, that's a great point, and you mentioned in the book how people put more time, and I think you mentioned it earlier, people put more effort into picking out shopping for a flat screen TV than they do their doctors or other healthcare treatment, which is something that we're all going to have to be better consumers, and a lot of young people I think are at this point.
Yeah, and one of the ways they can be helped now is with access to social media and the site. If you want to know about a particular condition, just don't have to Google and take whatever there is on the screen. You can go to the Cleveland Clinic, Johns Hopkins, Dana-Farber, University of Iowa. These are all first-rate medical systems in America, and they will have the best reliable information for you. And you can be an informed consumer with just a keystroke.
So your prognosis was good. You say in the book that while this form of cancer is treatable but not curable, the cancer was gone, and your future looks good. But you also talk in a very personal sense about living with cancer, which a lot of people do and a lot of family members. It does kind of change your outlook on some things.
I do, because I was not prepared for how difficult it was going to be. I'm honest here, but I'm a pretty tough guy. Covered, you know, stories all over the world under very difficult circumstances. I've been a climber, I'm a big trekker and an and a guy who's done, you know, gone into on foot into Nepal and under the Tibetan Plateau and climbed most of the big peaks in America. And I bicycled the year before I got diagnosed across parts of Chile and Argentina. But at the same time, when I got diagnosed, they weren't very candid with me about how difficult this could be. And because I had pretty significant bone damage, it became extremely painful. I had 4 fractures in my spine, for example. I had a hole in my pelvis. I had 2 compression fractures in the lower part of my back. And that resulted in very, very penetrating pain. There were times when I couldn't get out of bed, and I could barely walk. It would have been better for me to have been told that at the beginning. Look, Tom, this is going to be tough. We don't know how tough, but you've got to be prepared mentally and otherwise for how difficult it could be. But instead, I was told, well, hey, look, Tom, 9 months now, you'll be back to your old self again. Because they were trying to be, I suppose, kind of cheerleaders for me. I'd rather know the hard truth.
Well, for our listeners, again, the book is called A Lucky Life Interrupted, A Memoir of Hope. And I really recommend this to folks, not just those facing cancer or family members of those facing cancer, but it's a human interest story of facing adversity with strength and determination. And you're very upfront about the challenges you faced. And I think the other good part of the book is it includes some personal reminiscences of your journalism career. And I really think people would enjoy this book for a lot of reasons.
Well, thank you. It's getting a very good response on the New York Times bestseller list. Again, at 3, and the people who are reading it and writing about it are very generous. So I'm very grateful. This is my 7th book, and it's easily my most personal book. And I had some hesitation about whether I wanted to open myself up as much as I have here, but I did think that it was important that other families have a kind of guidance. It wasn't just poor Tommy has cancer. This is what you need to know.
Yeah, well, again, as somebody who's gone through this as a family member, I'm grateful because it did bring back a lot of memories, and I found myself agreeing with a lot of this. We're talking today with Tom Brokaw on Talking Politics with Robin Johnson. Let's switch gears a little bit. Since we do have the Iowa caucuses coming up and everything in Iowa right now is revolving around the caucuses, you've got, of course, Midwest connections. You were brought up in South Dakota. I really enjoyed the book you wrote about growing up in the Midwest, but you've got some good Iowa connections as well. How far back, Tom, do you go in covering the Iowa caucuses? Was it 76, the first one?
No, the first one was, yes, it was 76. That's right. I've been in every one since then.
What I
reminded somebody the other day is that they're very important because Iowans take them seriously, depending on whether they're a party, but there are people who won the Iowa caucuses and did not, or the straw vote, and did not get very far after that. People forget that George Bush 41 defeated Ronald Reagan in 1980 in Iowa. Pat Robertson won in Iowa. Michelle Bachmann showed up very well in the straw poll. So it's not an assurance that you're going to win the nomination necessarily. But it does. It's kind of the shakeout phase, as it were. And because Iowa is the heartland, and people take politics seriously, you do get to take the measure of the candidates who are running there.
I agree. I've been doing this show for a little over a year, and I found that Iowans take this responsibility very seriously. And they check on the candidates, and it requires candidates to be here. And it's not good enough just to run TV ads. You've got to be here and meet people and look them in the eye.
Between Iowa and New Hampshire, there's a kind of favorite line for journalists. You'll say to a citizen, if he's in one of those states, so what do you think about candidate X? And they'll say, I'm not sure. I've only met him 4 times. That's happened anywhere else.
So I assume you believe that Iowa should still be first in the nation's presidential contest in light of some voices that come up regularly to try to change it.
Well, that's not for me to say. I do think it's not a bad place to launch, but I think you have to keep everything in context. I think you have to remember that it is a Midwestern state. It's agriculturally oriented to a greater degree than other states are. It is not as ethnically diverse as other states are. But at the same time, the people there do take it very seriously. And there's a lot to be said for that. And then the next one is New Hampshire, and many of the same conditions that exist there. But it's not just civic pride in Iowa. It's also a huge economic benefit. You own a small radio station in Iowa, you can just sit back for the next year and count the money as it comes in. Go in an advertising agency or a billboard company or a medium-sized newspaper, you're going to do very well. And that doesn't include, mostly in the Des Moines area, the restaurants, the hotels, and the amount of money that the metal car companies are going to do well. That's a big economic boom for a state.
Yeah.
God bless them.
Are there any memories that stand out the most from your coverage of the Iowa caucuses over the years? Anything that stands out through the, you know, you covered the, of course, the Reagan years?
I remember the morning after when George Bush surprised Ronald Reagan and won Iowa. Here, Reagan was a kind of a native son of Iowa. He lived there in Des Moines in his early formative years. And I ran into Mr. Bush in the hotel the next morning, and he looked at me and said, "I got the big mo," and that was how he talked, and then that became kind of a cliche for that campaign. And then he lost to Reagan in New Hampshire, and then it was Katie bar the door, because Reagan really took off at that point. So that's really one of my fondest memories. And what happens for me, because I've spent so much time in Iowa, I went to university for a while, I worked in northern Iowa at a rock quarry one summer, I worked in Sioux City, Iowa at KTIV when I was in college. I commuted back and forth from Sioux City to the University of South Dakota. So I do have Iowa roots, and I get to see a lot of my friends when I'm there. And that's always very encouraging to me as well. And it's just a wonderful state with the prosperity comes with modern agriculture. And Des Moines has become a very sophisticated city. The University of Iowa and Iowa State both are absolutely first-rate institutions of higher learning. So it's kind of reassuring to go back to Iowa.
You know, in another book you wrote called The Time of Our Lives, which I really – I'll plug that one as well. My parents, there were so many things in there. You talk about the frugality of people growing up in the Depression era. And when they got done with a bar of soap when it was small, they would put it together with another one to reuse, which my parents did. And taking old rags or old clothing and using them as rags. I mean, these are the things that my parents did as well, because they grew up through the Depression. It's a really great book on a bygone era that still has lessons for today, I think.
Yeah, it marked that generation forever. And I think that the experience of the greatest generation of the Depression, the greatest generation, were very important when they went to fight the war. They learned about how to work together during the Depression, how to go without. When I would ask young men what they remembered from basic training as they prepared to go into World War II, they would always say, "I couldn't believe the great breakfast we were getting," or "I got my first new pair of boots, so I didn't have to have hand-me-down trousers. I was able to get new things." So the Depression helped prepare them for the extraordinarily and critical role that they played in fighting the Nazi threat. It was the greatest war in the history of mankind, and these people went from being farm kids, city kids in the Southwest, to overnight the greatest fighting force the world has ever seen. And the Depression had something to do with that.
In that book, you talk about the differences in gridlock and hyperpartisanship between now and previous years, and the historian Sean Wellens wrote a lengthy essay on how partisanship has always been a part of the United States for the most part, other than the James Monroe era, the era of good feelings and a brief period in the late 1800s. And he says we really shouldn't get too worried about it because it's in our political DNA. But you've talked in your books about how this is more of a threat now. Can you talk about that a little bit and how concerned people should be about the partisanship in Washington?
Well, the problem at the moment is that in Washington, it's now become – especially on the right, and to a large degree on the left as well, it's become a mark against you if you work with the other side to try to find common ground on something. The partisanship that you described there was the partisanship that would go on during campaigns. But, for example, people don't realize this, but there's an enormous amount of isolationism before we got involved in World War II, and that Roosevelt was thought of as a traitor to his class during the Depression for the government program that he had. But when was coming to our shores, whether we liked it or not. People rallied around that in Congress and otherwise, and that became very important. Look, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and there were deep divisions then about what was going on. People forget that John Kennedy, who is now seen as budgetary terms, barely won the presidency, and he was quite controversial during a fair amount of his term. But people, when he was assassinated, then turned to the idea of they knew they were dealing with, and that was very important.
As a son of a World War II and Korean War veteran who was a member of the Greatest Generation, of which you wrote, thank you for your work on behalf of veterans, and I wish you good continued good health, and God bless. Tom Brokaw, our guest today on Talking Politics with Robin Johnson.